Okay, this is let's get on the reel. Okay, we're on. This is Bob Smith and Joe Tatarevich with Ed Weiler, and we're in NASA headquarters, and it's the 9th of March.
Yes.
And this is Taipei Side 1.
Need a voice check.
We seem to be okay so far.
Okay.
The area that we were going to talk about today particularly is planetary tracking. And I wonder how, from your perspective, you became aware of this as an issue.
Okay. The issue of planetary tracking is primarily one of ground system, in the sense that you can't talk about planetary tracking without going into a whole story of SOG, the Science Operation Ground System. But let me say up front, in case there's any doubt left, that from day one, the space telescope hardware, that is the spacecraft system, was always designed to handle just about anything any planetary astronomer would ever want to do in a hardware sense, that it's capable of tracking volcanoes on Io or comets or whatever. The problem turned out to be primarily one of how do you get the ground system to enable the hardware to be used in that mode. That's the issue which I don't think anybody would really disagree with. I guess the
okay, but before you tell us when you first became aware of it, was the ability of the hardware to do these maneuvers, was that designed into the system for planetary tracking, or do you need that kind of capability in the system for fixed targets?
It was designed in for planetary tracking, contrary to what you may have heard. Let me give you one specific example. There were planetary astronomers involved in the original study teams, as you know, from historical studies. And one of the drivers, for instance, for the ST baffle, okay, in the sunshade, was that we be able to get within 45 degrees of the sun, 45 to 50 degrees of the sun. That's not an arbitrary angle. That happens to be the greatest elongation of Venus, and we wanted at least occasional opportunities to observe Venus. Okay, which gets out to be about 47 or something, I guess. And you probably realize that a baffle for a system that never gets closer than 90 degrees to the sun is very much simpler from a technical viewpoint, if you're worried about scattered light, which we are in space on a space telescope, than one that has to get you 50 or 45 degrees. The other driver that forced us to that kind of sunshade system were comets. Because if you can't observe a comet closer than 90 degrees to the sun, you're never going to see it even near perihelion. At least if you get to 45, then you have you'll see it in an active phase. Now, a planetary astronomer could say, oh my God, we should have designed so we could observe Mercury and Venus and the planets right next to the Sun. Well, you know, if you wanted to design an optical system that's capable of observing the 30th magnitude and also be able to point within a degree of the Sun, I don't think this country could afford it. All right, so any comments that or statements made, and there are many of them, that ST never took into account planetary desires, I think it's totally false. The record will show that it's not, that things were taken out. This all happened before my time, but it's not just an arbitrary fact that the ST can point to 50 to 45 degrees from the sun. Because mm-hmm. Yeah. One could say, well, why not 60? Why not 130? You know, it's,
yeah.
Okay. Let's see. When did I first become aware of the planetary tracking issue? I guess at some level, in my early involvement in the SOGS program, made me aware of a broader aspect of things that weren't in the system. And I never really got involved specifically in only the planetary side. When I came on board in 80 or 81, the Institute had not yet been formed. I guess it was formed shortly thereafter. One of the first things the Institute did for us was point out a lot of deficiencies in SOGS. Again, planetary weren't called out as being a special set. SOGS, in many cases, was deficient. You know the long history of that. I mean, there was never a really well-done set of requirements for SOGS. And that was if you have to put your finger on one reason why SOGS overran and overran and overran, it was the fact that the original project never did a good job on coming up with what should this system be capable of doing. So that's where the problem started, I would guess. Not only weren't there any planetary astronomers writing the original specs for SOGs. There were no astronomers, to my knowledge, who were intimately involved. It was primarily people like Mona Tisch and others and the original Goddard project. So SOGS was deficient. On the other hand, in defense of those people, I mean, you know, ST wasn't clearly defined in terms of how it was going to be operated back in the early 80s, late 70s, when those specs were written. Okay. To make a long story short, the real person who deserves all the credit for bringing the specific issue of planetary tracking to the fore was Bob Brown. He became project scientist. One of the, I believe the date of that was probably around the 84, that time frame, the 84 time frame. He was project scientist for 2 years and left in early 86. So 84 is probably the time. As project scientist, of course, he got much more intimately involved with the ST and the ST management structure and systems, engineering systems, than he would have been if he was just at the Institute. And what he saw was, yes, indeed, ST could track planets, but there was nothing in the ground system that would enable us to do more than take really just a short exposure, pretty pictures, basically, of planets. That is, to be able to follow a complex motion like an object on a rotating moon which revolves around a planet which is also moving, a very complex set of motion. The ground system is just not capable of, one, scheduling it, or two, executing it. Because the ground system would have to tell the ST in a series of very short commands how to keep moving in this complex way. Because the ST is basically an inertial system. It likes to stay at one point. If you want to move in some crazy series of arcs and turns and curlicues, you've got to command it to do that. So these issues were brought up by Bob. They were taken seriously. In fact, Bob, I forget the exact chronological events, but a series of events, but I'm sure you probably got that from other people. Bob set up some meetings. Stopak got involved. He basically took the lead. He deserves all the credit for identifying exactly what was missing and what had to be done. Okay, that's important. He took the responsibility of coming up with exactly what needed to be done in the ground system. That is, what software needed to be done, which systems needed to be affected, the real-time system, for instance, the SOGS, the planning system, and so on and so on. And it was a long list of things, some of them very big, some of them just pittances. The total cost of all that was about, and this was just a wag, so to speak, but the total cost back when he finalized this approach was about $4 million. And this was, the time frame of that was a pop review in, God, maybe you'll have to help me. I believe it was the summer pop review in 84, I believe. And these issues were brought up by the project for Bob. Bob didn't happen to be at that pop review because he went to a planetary scientist meeting. So there were no scientists at that meeting other than Dave LaCrone. I had other commitments on ST, and Bob was at a science meeting, and Dave LaCrone was the representative of science at that meeting. Dave fought valiantly for it, but because, as you well know, at pop reviews, there's always about 10 times more money needed than available for other problems. This particular set of $4 million requirements was, just not acted on, not funded. And Bob decided to appeal that by coming directly to Charlie Pellerin. The trouble is, he did that after the budget had already been sent to Fletcher. That is, he did that in August or September time frame, and the budget is locked up once it leaves Code E, and the budget had left Code E, I think, 2 or 3 days earlier when Bob had come up. But Charlie still, held a meeting, which involved Chuck Fugel, Frank Carr, myself, Charlie, David Crone. We had the meeting, and Bob came in and basically presented an all-or-nothing type deal. That is, we must have all these. Had no priority order, on the items. And, you know, when given, I think it's fair to call, given an ultimatum, my boss, Charlie Pellerin, tends to react the way most managers would when given ultimatums. And the answer was nothing. No. After this, a whole bunch of political things started happening. I don't know who was the direct source of it, but letters started to come in mysteriously from very high-ranking planetary astronomers to various people, including Evelson and Rosenthal and whomever. Some of these letters were well thought out and knew the facts correctly, but others were totally not thought out in the sense of accusing NASA of not having any planetary astronomers involved with ST, or that ST can't do any planetary astronomy, which was false because ST could take at least photographs and images, which is a good first start because, frankly, that's what the public's going to be interested in, not what the scientists want, of course, justifiably so. These letters finally got into an ad hominem attack on Charlie Pellerin as out to kill planetary astronomy on ST, which was extremely regrettable because I don't think Charlie had anything against planetary astronomy, and frankly made the only decision he could given the facts of the situation. He was not presented a prioritized list. He was not presented that list in time to have any effect on it in the near-term budgets. Okay, well, Jeff Rosenthal finally got involved, and he decided to have a meeting on what the situation was. What exactly could ST do? What exactly could ST not do? That meeting was held at headquarters. It was probably in the fall time frame, maybe 85. Yeah, it was fall of 85. I might have my timing incorrect there. It was fall of 84, I guess. I may be off 1 year.
Yeah, this Brown moved to Marshall
late 83.
Late 83, early 84. His first science working group meeting, spring 84.
Okay, then. Then this pop review may have, okay, I may have been a year early. It may have taken Bob an extra year to do all this. The budget, the pop thing might have been the summer 85 pop, August 85 time frame, when Brown came in.
Okay. I think Lanzarotti writes in, I think that's late 85.
Okay, so that's it. Okay. So the pop review that Bob didn't attend was July of 85. The meeting with Pellerin was in August of 85, after the budget had gone. In fact, if it's really important, I could probably find the exact date. And the Rosenthal meeting was in the fall of 85. That's correct. Okay.
Yeah, because I think Lanzarotti actually put in his letter, I thought I should bring this problematic concern to the attention of Jeff Rosenthal.
Okay, so I think I told you who was at the meeting. Frank Carr, Chuck Fischel, David Crone.
This is with Rosenthal?
With Rosenthal.
Okay.
Myself, Charlie, Jim Welch. And Dave Skillman gave the presentation from the project as to what ST could do, what it could not do. Okay, obviously Jeff was, interested in hearing the other side of the story as opposed to what he was getting in the letters, and he came up with what I thought was a good suggestion, which most of us thought was a logical move, and that was, hey, there seemed to be a lot of really important things in this list of Bob Brown's. There also seemed to be a lot of things that would be nice to have, would be conveniences, would mean astronomers wouldn't have to, you know, maybe fill up a page of paper, pen and pencil, doing their own calculations, but ultimately would be nice to have. I'll bet you if we go study this, we'll find out that we could probably do 70 or 80% of these things for 20 or 30% of the $4 million. Okay. So he commissioned Goddard to form a moving targets assessment group, and John Clark was put in charge of that by Frank Carr. John got together some heavyweights in the planetary community, but not necessarily the loud heavyweights, the ones that would actually do some work, like Mike Belton and a few others. I don't know the exact names of that committee, but I'm sure you can get that from many of your other interviews or just by calling John Clark. John chaired the group. I believe they met in the February time frame of 86. They went through all the desirements in the original Bob Brown list found out that indeed you could get about 70 to 80%, you know, somewhere around that number, probably more like 70% of all the things planetary astronomers wanted for about $1 to $2 million, about half of the original cost. Moreover, they prioritized it that way. They said, hey, we've got to have these things right away by launch if possible. And these things included like the NAIF system, which I don't know what the acronym is, but it's basically a scheduling tool in the sense that it will help the SOG system find planets, moons, occultations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And JPL was funded eventually to go off to enhance their system. They were building the system anyway for Voyager flybys and planetary spacecraft, but with some changes, like, you know, putting it in an ST system as opposed to a Voyager system, Voyager-centered system, they could do it and make it adaptable to the SOG system. And there were some other things included, changes to SOGs and sort of things like that. And then there was the remaining list, which were things that the committee, the MTAG, recommended that we continue studying and try to implement as soon as we could. This was received very positively by just about everybody, including Charlie, who immediately, with Welch, decided to fund it. Okay, so it was funded starting in 86. It was presented to the Science Working Group and everybody interested. We then had another meeting with Rosendahl, spring time frame. 1986, he saw what we were doing and he thought we were going down a very logical course. Now, of course, Challenger happened just before all these things, and we had a major launch slip. And it became apparent that we could now probably get at least the high priority things from the MTAG incorporated into the system before launch. That is, of course, if the Institute put it on high enough priority within their own list of things to do, which I believe it has subsequently. Okay, so of course Bob Brown, representing his community, did a good job in continually pointing out to the project that we still have to, you know, think about these other things. And that almost brings us up to the current situation. That is the last Science Working Group. Bob gave a presentation on all the things that weren't being done. And, of course, there was no cost figure in there, and I have no idea to this day what they cost. And the Science Working Group blessed the importance of these things and that they should be done on a timely basis, and at least a plan should be developed which shows how they will be done over the many years up to launch and beyond launch. So, in capsule, that's the whole thing. I mean, there was a lot of... a lot of nasty things going on, stirring up of the community, backbiting and things like that on both sides of the coin, both within NASA and outside of NASA. I think it's regrettable because Charlie Pellerin got labeled as a person who didn't care about planetary astronomy, which is really totally false. I mean, we fund all planetary astronomy done in IUE, we fund all planetary astronomy done in the C-141, and we have always intended to fund all planetary astronomy done with the Space Telescope. Many planetary astronomers fear they won't get their fair share of time on Space Telescope. They complain to NASA about that. But that's one area where the Institute is going to have to do their job, because NASA does not dictate to the Institute that planetary shall only get 1% or 10% or whatever. Theoretically, that's supposed to be judged purely by peer review. And indeed, on IUE, through peer review, people get most of the time they want. From 5 to 10% a year goes to planetary astronomy on IUE. The bottom line is, I don't think there was any Machiavelli intent by anybody to hurt planetary science or keep planetary scientists out of the Space Telescope system. You guys who have worked on the history know that there have been continual budget problems on ST. There have been continuing technical problems on ST. And, when somebody comes up with $4 million of unprioritized requirements and then puts them all under the umbrella of level one requirement, you know, there is a level one requirement that we can do the best science we can on planets. On the other hand, there are a lot of other level one requirements that are going to be tough to meet and we're having to fight for right now, like making sure we have enough power on the system. Like, it's a level one requirement that the system not run out of power. And, you know, that's a $10 million hit. You don't just run off and do things, you know, to because it's a level one requirement. And that's one message I don't think Bob ever understood in this whole thing, and that is, you know, he was a planetary scientist, and that was his prime concern, you know. But there are a lot of other concerns that we weren't meeting and didn't have money to meet, which affected far more than planetary astronomy. They affected 90% of the people who could be using ST, not just the 10% or whatever the number is. So what I'm trying to get at here is that I don't think anybody deserves a black hat in this whole situation. I think NASA would be the first ones to admit that they underscoped SOGS in terms of planetary tracking, but in terms of a lot of other requirements for the operation system. And once we were presented with a reasonable plan, well thought out, prioritized, which we knew would be the most efficient way to incorporate all these things that planetary astronomers wanted, they were immediately accepted. And I think the real bottom line is that it was the personality of the pusher of these requirements that hurt more than anything else. Even though Bob deserves all the credit for uncovering this and leading us to a solution, the solution could have come much earlier if the personal style was slightly less ultimatum style, if that makes any sense. Bob never in his years as project scientist really learned how to work with the rest of NASA. That would have to be a bottom line answer. And I think even Bob would have done that. He always had a lot of problems understanding, as I still do, why decisions are made the way they are. Sometimes you sort of have to grin and bear it.
How do you actually go about change? Say there's something in the system that you're opposed to, and you think, well, we must do this. How would you go about changing it? Or what is the effective way for someone to operate within the system?
Okay, let me speak from a project scientist perspective, the way I would have handled the planetary tracking issue if I was Bob, and assuming I had Bob's talents in uncovering all the problems and understanding them. The way a project scientist is effective, actually this is why Black Saturday happened too, it's the same story, it's what you, this, you know, those things are examples of how you're not effective. The way a project scientist can be effective on an issue that he really cares about and believes he can be supported on is take the planetary tracking plan. Bob first should have come to the STOPAT and the science working group and uncovered the problem. And he should have then gotten volunteers from both those committees and the planetary committee to the planetary community to sit down and really study what are the issues. What are the ones we really have to have by launch? What are the ones we can delay a little bit? And come in with a prioritized plan with various funding levels that you can go to management with, okay, where they could pick one from column A, one from column B. Management has a very hard time sometimes to be given a lump sum and then be told, we got to have it right now. I mean, that's not a good way to sell anything within an industry or within the government. So once that committee would have gotten together and you know, worked these things out, Bob should have then worked with myself and Dave McCrone, for instance, the scientist within NASA, and to get a joint position, which we often do on many issues, and then take it on a personal level to Charlie and Jim and say, hey, you know, let's look at this, let's see what we can do, you know. And when it's done that way, oftentimes you are successful. You know, there are many examples of that.
Would maybe BLESS and the A and B testing be one?
I think so, although that took a lot more firepower and
bigger
work. That was a bigger rock to because there you were fighting philosophy of a corporation, not trying to get a science decision made. I'm trying to think of a good example of how the system works. Well, the clone is a somewhat good example, in the sense, although we ran into a roadblock at first, it ultimately came out right, because to be fair, Jim Welch was another project long at that point in time, and didn't like to be hit with another $30 or $40 million thing right off the top. Actually, let's not talk about that, because that's not a good example of what I'm saying. I'll think about it.
Well, one episode from an earlier time was, I was looking at recently, was the actuators on the mirror, where there seemed to be a number of people who got involved, and also at one point the aperture door. This was in the in early 80, where there were letters saying God, there was a Goddard position established.
That was before my time. Actually, there hasn't been a lot of examples of large things that were done in a smooth managerial sense, smooth way. There are a lot of examples of very small things that have been done. I'm drawing a blank right now. That's embarrassing. There are things done every day like that, where we get the right thing done, but it's not done in a necessarily formal way. You know, having meetings, getting people together, coming up with a position, presenting it to management, so on.
Yeah, I was just wondering about just the effectiveness of people within the system. And it seems its ability to have these kind of work within these informal networks.
That's the key, Bob. You just struck on the key. That's what's been bothering me, because I just told you how the planetary thing was handled wrong from my perspective, from the project scientist role. You're exactly right. The way things really get done is you do have informal. You know, if I want to get Jim Welch or Charlie Pellerin to approve something that costs money, there are various ways I can do it successfully. I can go have a chat with Charlie, if it's a simple thing. And I've got to be the judge of that, because I don't want to fail the first time. Because once you fail, it's a much more difficult thing to get it started again. All right. You know, in some cases, I might want to talk to Bob Bless or Jim Westfall or Rich Harms, and maybe get four of the PIs to come in to talk with Charlie if it's a joint issue. Some things I'll just get Al Bagas involved with, and he and I will approach Charlie or Jim or even Frank Carr. Sometimes I even work at the project level to help sell things. It's to be successful, it's knowing who to call, who to get involved, and when to approach who. That's really more the way it actually works. And the clone thing was more of an example of that. We started out the right way. I had a Christmas holiday where everybody was gone and I was working, so I just sat down one day and decided to write a white paper on M&R, because that's been one of my chief pedestals for screaming on for many, many years, especially in regards to the science aspect of M&R, because that seems to have been and continues to be a poor child of the Space Telescope project. And so I started out by writing a white paper, gave it to a few people to comment on, like Frank Carr and others. Then took it to the STOPAT, had a long discussion, got them to basically bless it, and took it to the Science Working Group, get them to bless it. And within that thing, it really called out a clone as being absolutely necessary. The day of the Science Working Group, when it was blessed, Welch went nonlinear. To be fair, that's one thing I hadn't done properly, and that is to sort of brief Jim. I just was getting to know Jim, and I didn't realize he needed to be stroked before. He didn't like, in those days, he didn't like the Science Working Group usurping his role as manager, director of the program. And he felt that by the Science Working Group blessing this thing, that it might be considered a fait accompli by somebody. Because again, he was still young in the program. And so I don't think Jim reacted badly. It just was, I may not have done my job as well as I should have, not knowing Jim well enough. So after that, after Welch really got negative about it, and of course Jim was very close to Sam, so Sam was of course queasy about it, we started a lobbying campaign with Jim. Various people talked to him, various people talked to Charlie. Charlie was only lukewarm up on it too. What finally happened, of course Bob Brown was a very big supporter too at the time. Bob, to his credit, actually, at a pop review, and this one I don't remember, this has got to be in the 84 time frame, I guess, one of the 84 pops. Bob put together a presentation with overlay view graphs and a very pretty presentation, which really made Jim understand more than just WFPIC science, but how WFPIC was absolutely necessary to do a lot of the astrophysics and planetary science, where you need a finder camera to really find the point you want to look with your spectrographs. That, I think, was what sold Jim. He really understood that the WFPIC was more than a science instrument. It was also a finder scope for ST, in a sense. And shortly thereafter, Jim gave approval to go ahead with it. So that's an example of program and project scientists working well together. I made the initial mistake of going too fast with Jim, and then Bob sort of followed the elephant with the shovel.
There's been a lot of over the years, a lot of personnel changes in the program, at program level, at project level, all over.
There'll probably be more coming too.
And especially at headquarters here, you seem to pick up a lot of people from the scientific community who come in and spend a couple of years here and then move on. How can they be effective? I mean, one of the strengths is that you want to get people from the outside community and get some fresh ideas and some better contact with the community. At the same time, do they tend to? Do you have to train every one of them as they come in to be more or less effective in the style of doing things?
I think that the idea of it might work at NSF because they don't manage any projects; all they do is grants. Okay, so at the NSF, the system probably works very well. The only thing an NSF scientist does is basically get proposals from the outside, have them peer reviewed, and make a decision. That's about 1% of my job. I delegate that to my junior staff, basically. The real job at NASA is a program science function. All right. And I categorically disagree with the idea that you can bring in somebody here into headquarters at a senior management level, line management level, in the science line. Expect them to get up to speed, learn the system, learn how to get things done, which is the key thing, learning how to get things done, and do all that in 2 years and be effective more than your last month. You know, about the 2-year level, you start to get effective. All right? But there is no way in a program as complex as Space Telescope where you can learn how to get things done, especially if you believe the hypothesis that getting things done is primarily an informal thing, getting the right people to talk to the right people at the right time. Right? Learning the system is just not doable in less than a year or two. I wasn't effective on Space Telescope until my second or third year. I sat in the background and sort of listened. And I was at the science working group when the working group confronted Bob Odell for the first time with his quote-unquote decisions on taking the spectrographs off. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that whole meeting. Because I started out at Goddard, then I came to headquarters, so I knew center and headquarters roles. And the idea that a project scientist could ever make a quote-unquote decision to take science scope out was just totally alien to me. And I was interested from a philosophical viewpoint how the working group was going to deal with their leader. And they dealt with him pretty badly, so to speak. But I stayed in the background on ST for at least a year, year and a half, before I ever really got actively involved. Try to exert an influence of any kind. And the other thing you said, which I would take issue with, is that people will say, well, you need to bring people in every 2 years, get new blood and all that, keep contact with the community. Program scientists, like myself or other people around here, may not do a lot of research anymore, if at all, but keeping in contact with new ideas and community is, believe me, no problem at all. I can't get off the phone most of the time. I mean, I get calls at home from people. They feel free to call me at home or when I'm on travel. So I have more, frankly, I have more contact with the community than I think is desirable. I would never say that at an AAS meeting, mm-hmm. for instance, but, you develop a certain, anybody who works in this job for long enough develops a certain group of people who are confidants and people who you trust to give you good advice. And then, of course, you're exposed to all the advisory committee network, which sometimes gives good advice and sometimes doesn't. You know, so, you know, people on my list would be people like Jeff Linsky, Andre Dupree, Jim Westfall, Bob Less. I mean, there's a whole Bruce Margon. I mean, there's a whole list of people that I feel free to call at any time for advice or whatever. And it goes both ways. You know, so I think if you don't develop that kind of thing, if you don't stay in touch that way, you're not doing your job. Some examples of programs that have had a program scientist, for instance, could be a project scientist too, but had that person from the day that the mission was first conceived, the day it was launched, to the day the data started coming in. IRAS is a classic example. Nancy Bogus is a program scientist on IRAS in the dim past, you know, when the idea of cryogenic telescopes in space were laughed at by people in the DOD. Well, someday, if you want to do a short history on something, you should get Nancy to talk about initial reactions from the DOD on IRAS. But interesting stories, though. But there's an example where a senior person was involved with the program at headquarters from day one, all the way through the mission. The mission had countless technical problems. I mean, it was ready to be canceled several times. In fact, we had a deputy administrator who said there it would be a miracle if it worked the night before launch. Of course, it did work and was tremendously successful. And now the guest observer program is extremely successful. And I credit a lot of the team staying together and working on it through thick and thin and not losing morale and so on to people like Nancy. I mean, that's her job, you know, to keep morale up and to get things done when they need it done. If somebody's, you know, grant was a little late to keep them alive as an IRAS science team member, should make sure it got fixed, because you know, it's bad enough when you have technical problems if you don't have the money to pay yourself. You know? And there are countless examples of little things that she would do to keep things going. You know, if that was a program that had three or four program scientists or project scientists on it, you know, it may still have been successful, but I think it'd been a lot more painful for a lot of people. You know, regrettably, ST, I think, would have been a lot easier for the scientist, a lot less frustration if they had a project scientist from day one all the way through, and a program scientist from day one all the way through, who worked well together.
And maybe a program manager, too.
Oh, sure. Anything I say for scientists applies to program manager, except I'm talking more now in terms of the dealings with the scientist, getting their concerns taken care of, keeping them, their spirits and morale high, and the goals in front of us and all that good stuff. Sure. You know, a lot of this could be said on the other side of this coin too.
Yeah, because there seems to be this kind of tension between somebody's career trajectory and the sort of good of the project.
Well, and then you get into the relationship of the scientists with the managers, or the science managers with the other managers, technical managers, money managers, because we're all theoretically managers. For instance, right now, Al and I have been personal friends for a long, long time, and then Al became project scientist. There's almost nothing that Al and I ever disagree on. We seem to think very much alike, and that presents that enables a very effective science advocacy. Whether it's getting things done for science with Jim Welch or Frank Carr or whomever. And when Al and I take a position, and it isn't necessarily an institute position, where we have a much more effective negotiation with Ricardo, for instance. And I really wish that on ST, Alan, you know, that kind of relationship had been established early, you know, between whoever was in those jobs, all the way through. We've got it now, and I hope we can stay together. An example of science with the management. Jim Odom has left, you know, and this has happened throughout the project. I had a very good relationship with Jim, so did Al. There are things that, you know, if Marshall was doing something or some lower level in the lower level person in M&R was screwing the advanced instruments, I could call Jim up, and Jim really had, one thing I can say for Jim Odom, he really had a good perspective on the often forgotten item that we're not launching this as a technical demonstration of NASA's ability to launch a big system. We're launching it to do science. That's very rare for a project manager to really understand that at an intimate level, and Jim Odom did. That's not to say that his replacement, Jerry, doesn't. It's just it's going to take Al and I a long time to establish as good of a relationship with Jerry and be able to be effective in getting things for science. Trouble is, we've had, as you pointed out, the same works for the relationship with the program manager to the scientist. I mean, you know, we've had 5 or 6 or 7 program managers. Jim Odom is not the first project manager to leave, as you well know. So the key to success in a program is, of course, to have capable people in the management chain, but to keep them there throughout the project. And that may be impossible on programs like ST. I don't know. Maybe they're too long. Or maybe maybe the perks and encouragement within the system are wrong to accomplish that goal.
Yeah, if you set up some sort of career structure and salary structure, which encourages people to move up and out,
that's right.
Then
that's right. That could. That, I hadn't thought of it before. Maybe the system doesn't allow that kind of thing to happen.
It seems almost as if it encourages people to fairly short stints.
That's right.
And then move on.
See, my own personal point of view is that I have no great desires to move up the so-called chain to become division director or AA because. Frankly, I think I could do more for astronomy where I am, where I have more direct control and direct experience with the outside community. As you move up the chain, you lose that contact. And if I moved up the chain, I'd almost cease to be a scientist and almost surely be just a manager. Just a manager. And there's something even more important, that is that, I think this is true for probably Al Boggess too. You work on a program for 2, 3, 4, 5 years like I have. And something as important as ST, and you feel like you put a lot of blood into it, there's nothing that would get me off this program until it's launched. After it's launched is a different story. But I'll be here when this thing is launched, if I have any say in it. Because you put too much of your life into it. You know, if you're a program manager and only worked on it for a year and something better comes along, then you don't have that. You know, you don't have to have the personal personality to have that kind of commitment. You have to have the time. You know, if I only worked on this for a year and they offered I could go off and work on something more interesting at that point in my career, I'd probably do it. But once you put in a lot of years on something, theoretically, you're more likely to stay with it. The trouble is we don't have a lot of people like that other than the scientists in this program.
This relationship between the program or project level scientist and manager, from your perspective, how effective do you think that Brown and Odom were together? What kind of a team were they?
I really don't want to answer that on the record because people have given me confidence. They have trusted their confidence or my confidence. They have said things to me in confidence. On the other hand, just looking at them from the outside, I think anybody fairly would say that Bob did not spend a lot of time at Marshall. I mean, the record will show that. He spent most of his time on the road. Most of it, very important stuff, like going to Lockheed to worry about A and B and things like that. But, you know, he and Jim didn't get a lot of time together. And that didn't lead to a super effective relationship. I think it was a moderately good relationship. But it could have been better. How, I don't know, because I wasn't down there.
The reason I ask that is that there's the predecessor to the MTAG was the Planetary Target Implementation Team.
Yeah. That's the group I was trying to. That was led by Bob Brown, right?
And that was chaired by Chuck Fuchel and Mike Harrington, co-chaired by Fuchel and Harrington. And if I recall correctly, it was set up at project level.
Yeah, that's
correct.
That was clearly with Odom's cooperation and blessing.
Oh no, Bob was effective in getting Jim Odom to do as much as he could for planetary tracking. No question about it. Mm-hmm. That was very effective. I thought Bob had chaired that committee, but you're right. He probably was a major actor in that committee's workings.
Well, there were three committees.
Shall I just turn over?